We don't know who is behind this, nor their intent.
It's a reality of modern cyber warfare. Governments and political parties have to assume that they are always under attack from foreign powers. This week, the assumptions were realised.
The methods used by malicious actors are constantly evolving, and this incident just reinforces yet again the importance of cybersecurity as a fundamental part of everyone's business.
The Liberal, Labor and National parties were targeted in an unprecedented hack that could have exposed voter and MP data ahead of the federal election. How much and what sort of data? Even the experts don't know.
What we know is that a malicious state actor has gained access to various networks.
One foreign actor was quickly identified as a key suspect. China. Our relationship with China is always at odds. If it isn't tension about the South China Sea, or investment in the Pacific Islands, it's trade, or a ban against the Chinese-owned Huawei from constructing our 5G network. Malcolm Turnbull's foreign interference legislation only added fuel to the fire.
There has been a degree of tension in the relationship that has arisen because of criticism in China of our foreign interference laws.
Authorities haven't confirmed the source of the recent attack, and the Chinese Foreign Ministry has called accusations against it groundless. But it's not the first time Australia has been hit with Chinese cyber attacks. And with the election likely only months away, could it happen again? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast that gives the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia. I'm Tori Maguire. Later on, we'll chat to senior writer Gary Maddox, who will give us his take on the tumultuous lead-up to the Oscars. But first, I'm joined by David Rowe, Defence and National Security Correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Hello, David.
Hi.
And Chris Yorman, Channel 9's political editor and new regular columnist in The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Hi, Chris.
G'day, Tori.
David, can you start by telling us exactly what the Prime Minister told the nation had happened when he announced it in Parliament this week?
Sure. So what he described as a sophisticated state actor hacked not just the parliamentary network that is used by all MPs and their staff, but also the three major political parties, the Liberal, Labor and National parties. At least cyber attacks were launched at them. We don't know the full extent of the breach. They've also said that they don't know exactly what was accessed or taken. They haven't named the country involved, but I think it's fair to say that the prime suspect is China, both because of the nature of the attack, the level of sophistication, and also China's track record in launching cyber attacks against Australian government branches. Or they are saying they don't know what was taken or what was accessed. It's very difficult to say that it wasn't a political interference case because, you know, we don't know what they took and we don't know how they might use it over the next 3 months, particularly in the run-up to the federal election.
Given that we don't know who it was or what they took, how do we know anything happened at all?
Because the Australian Signals Directorate, which is the government's main cyber spying agency and who also provides cyber defence to the government, has discovered and detected significant evidence, footprints of a breach, as they said, by a sophisticated actor who knew how to cover their tracks, who knew where to put the malicious software or malware that they were using and insert it into the system so that they can presumably access data. There's quite significant forensic digital evidence that they have left despite their efforts to cover it up, and that tells the ASD that something quite serious has happened.
Chris, Scott Morrison has been very specific and very careful in his language whenever he's been asked about who he has been told is responsible, to the point where he has even said, I'm being very specific and very careful in my language. Is there any chance it was someone other than the Chinese?
Yes, there is, but that's the concern of the people who are looking into this. This is a novel attack, so they haven't seen this particular form before. And as David said, there are a couple of reasons why people jump to saying that it is China. One is that they have a long track record in Australia. They've attacked the Australian Parliament House website before, not the website, the email system before in 2011. We know that was the case and we know it was them. They've certainly attacked the Australian Bureau of Meteorology and the ANU, along with lots and lots of others. So much so, in fact, that they were called out in December last year by the Five Eyes intelligence sharing partnership across the Western nations. China was called out as basically being involved in industrial scale cyber espionage against private companies and against governments. So, you know, that's why China gets tagged. But there's always the possibility, Tory, that it's another country masquerading as China, and there are different elements to what we're seeing here, even though it's been described as the A-team. Good enough to get in, we're told, but not good enough to not be caught. So, yep. You know, I think it is wise to hasten slowly.
So what would be the motivation? Why would China want to hack into our government systems and now our political parties? What are they looking for?
Well, they're looking for political information, obviously sensitive information. They would see relationships between people. They'd be able to understand really who's who in the zoo in Australia. If you think about the last attack, I remember a Labor Party person saying to me, there's a huge warehouse somewhere in China where all our emails are spread out and they're doing links between who knows who and who knows what. Imagine the things that you've got on your email system which might be indiscreet. Imagine that they appear during an election campaign. Now, that's the real fear.
It's horrifying, isn't it?
Is that some of this information, which might carry, you know, if not sensitive, then very embarrassing information, not just between government and opposition MPs, but between staffers, might leak into the public during an election campaign. And of course, we know that that can happen because that's what did happen in the 2016 presidential election.
But what would be the point? I mean, would it be as simple and blunt as a foreign state wanting to basically pick a side, like we saw in the United States? You know, would China be looking at Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison and weighing them up through the lens of China's interests and going, okay, well, if we want one of these, we have to kind of undermine the other one?
Well, we don't know, and they might have no intention of using this information in that way. What they would gather by being in the parliamentary system is a much deeper understanding of the way the place works, the people in it, what their relationships are, and some of the information on those non-secure sites, in fact, would carry some level of intelligence value. So, look, someone once said to me that the difference the way that the Russians, the Americans and the Chinese go about gathering information is if the Americans want to know something about beach, they take a picture of it from space. If the Russians want to know something about a beach, they send two 16-year-olds to the country and they say, when you're 18, go to the beach and have a swim. If the Chinese want to know something about a beach, they send 1,000 people to the beach each to pick up a grain of sand. So this might be low level of intelligence, but it's all worth gathering.
They may not have decided how they're going to use it at all. I mean, it's always useful to gather intelligence according to just, you know, it's just traditional government against government espionage. They may look around and decide at some stage down the track that they might, you know, it might be beneficial to them to release something in a judicious and tactical way to produce a particular outcome. The other thing, just on the question of actually interfering in democracy, they don't necessarily want to pick one side of politics over another. It might be just enough for the Chinese to undermine Australians' faith in the democratic process. If you look at what's happened in the United States, I mean, clearly Russia did favour Donald Trump and all of their activity points to that. But also, they've really tied up Washington for 2 years with the Mueller investigations, with doubt, with suspicion. It's really, I'm referring to Russia, of course, here. They've really kind of paralyzed Washington in a lot of ways, and that's a huge strategic advantage to Russia. China has a long-term strategic interest, I think, in undermining faith in democracy, because they are essentially presenting an alternative political system to the world, which is one of a kind of techno-autocracy. And for them to be able to say, look, you know, our system is working very efficiently, we're getting things done, we're growing as a power and as an economy. Meanwhile, your democracy has become very messy and inefficient and it's not really working out for you very well. You know,
we're doing a lot of that to ourselves.
Of course. And one thing, you know, what Russia did really skillfully was not to was not to trash US democracy, but exploit existing divisions in US society, whether it's along the lines of race, along the lines of political ideology. Fortunately, I don't think Australia quite has that kind of polarisation yet, at least, but it's worth looking out for existing fissures in Australian society that could be exploited.
And Tori, there is another possibility too, which is why the agencies aren't rushing to say who this was. There's always the possibility, given there's tension between Australia and China, that another country has done this in order to exacerbate those tensions. Now, that's not also beyond the realms of possibility. So, we don't know. Well, exactly. At this stage, we don't know. But there is a concern among the people who look at that is actually a possibility.
Mm. Is it certain that an attack like this could only be conducted by a state? I mean, that's the Prime Minister said that they knew it was a state because of the sophistication. Are we at risk of, private billionaires being able to fund attacks like this at some point?
I'll jump in, but I mean, look,
yeah, do.
I freely admit to not being technically proficient enough to know exactly sort of what the fingerprints and signatures are that that the ASD and others are referring to. But look, in the case as both Chris and I have reported during the week, there's really a handful of countries that have this level of sophistication. China is one of them. Russia is another. Israel, the United States, a couple of other maybe Western countries. I would possibly throw Iran in there as well. It is a pretty exclusive club. I wouldn't rule out if there was a James Bond-style villainous billionaire, especially since there are so many billionaires who are obviously in the tech industry now. Being able to fund this kind of thing, I certainly wouldn't rule it out, but I don't think anyone is suggesting at the moment that any of them would have a particular motivation for doing so.
We're certainly learning a lot, aren't we, about our vulnerability. I mean, every time something like this happens, the Australian government has to sort of scramble, and they're sophisticated enough to know that it's happened, but not sophisticated enough to prevent it. In a completely unrelated matter this week, I was really shocked to hear that in the case of Hakim and how the breakdown in communication that led to his arrest in Thailand was partly put down to Border Force having computer systems that in some cases are up to 30 years old. No wonder we're so vulnerable.
Oh, yeah, now social security systems are very old too. And look, there are a whole bunch of systems which are now being patched together, and we live in an interconnected world, so it's impossible to keep people out. It is already possible with the old systems that do things, for example, like open the floodgates on dams, that can be hacked into and they can be opened remotely. The systems that turn our traffic lights from red to green can now be hacked into and they can now be changed. The huge fear, and this is why 5G has become such a thing, is that in a much more integrated world where almost every system relies on 5G, that enormous damage, enormous irreparable economic damage could be done by someone who could control that system. And that's why that is such a hot debate today.
Well, this brings us to the perennial topic of Huawei, doesn't it? The Chinese technology company. We've talked about this before, Chris, but more and more government agencies are raising concerns about Huawei and other Chinese players being involved in the construction of 5G. It's reached a point, hasn't it, where really at least the countries involved in Five Eyes are going to have to pull the pin on them being involved at all, aren't they?
Well, there's an open debate on that. The initial reaction from the Five Eyes countries was, yes, they were all acting in unison, but we've seen many things happen since then. The UK has always had a problem because Huawei's already in its system, so that involves it digging Huawei out of its 4G and banning it from its 5G. Now, there's been a technical report in the UK which says that they believe that they can manage Huawei inside the system, so that's a win for the company. A long way yet to go in the UK. That's not settled yet because there are a lot of other things for them to consider. New Zealand's been the latest country to be put in the freezer by China because of its decision on Huawei. So I would watch that space with interest and see what happens. Canada has yet to move because, well, a couple of Canadian citizens are actually being held in China because the Chinese chief financial officer for Huawei is being held in Canada. So there's a bit of a Mexican standoff with hostages there, you might say. So, look, this is an extremely vexed argument at the moment. But all I would say on this subject is, if the way that the Chinese government has reacted to the rejection of Huawei, if you like, by the West is any guide, then the Chinese government sees that company as enormously important to what's happening in the state. They are indivisible.
And the flip side to that, I'd just add, is that that is part of the reason, I think, why Australia and other Five Eyes countries were so concerned about Huawei. It's not just that they can plant bugs in the system and that kind of thing. It's also that the long-term sovereignty and industrial policy questions that face us about essentially having one or two companies worldwide who are able to provide this kind of stuff at an affordable cost, and the risk of Huawei just growing ever, ever larger. Now, obviously that's a trade question. It's an economic question. It's one that we don't particularly want to admit to, because in theory we're all open economic free traders, and we don't want to say, well, we're going to deliberately exclude a Chinese company because we don't want it to grow too big. But I think that's definitely part of it over the long run. We were in a position where, you know, if we continue down this track, we are going to become ever more dependent on, you know, a couple of Chinese companies that we, you know, a couple of companies based in a country that we see as a long-term strategic risk.
It's been more than 46 years since Australia and China formally established a diplomatic relationship. It would have been impossible at that time for them to foresee that we would be facing issues like this. Where to from here, do you think, for our relationship with China? I put that to both of you.
Oh, look, I think it is always going to be an extremely difficult relationship. We are now in utterly uncharted waters. For the first time in Australia's history, our major trading partner is not a liberal democracy, and it is a strategic rival of our major ally. Now, that puts us in an extraordinarily uncomfortable position, and Australia has no China policy. It becomes more and more evident every day. The only thing government ministers will say to you, and the opposition as well, is that we do not have to make a choice. Well, I'm sorry. The United States is forcing us to make choices on some of the issues that matter to it. China wants us to make choices on some of the issues that matter to it. And we can't continue to walk this uncomfortable line without coming up against a series of problems. And look, we face a circumstance too where the United States, through its president, has become at least an unpredictable security partner. So what does Australia do? Where do we go from here in order to make our own way? And what are we prepared to compromise on? And one of the things that China clearly demands in having an economic relationship with it, it's evident in everything that it does, is that we shut up about the things that it wants to do. That includes the way that it treats the Uyghurs inside its borders. It includes the way that it deals with the rest of the world. What it wants from us is our silence. Mm. And I think that's a pretty high price.
David, how large does it loom in the conversations that you have with security officials in Canberra? Does it take up a large chunk of people's attention?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's by far the biggest question that that we're grappling with. And you know, I accept Chris's point that we don't have a China policy or a China strategy, but I think that's, well, it's partly because we, you know, there are plenty of capable people working on it, but it's a devilishly hard question to answer in order to formulate a policy. I mean, China is, it's grown at a pace that no country has grown at before. It wants to fundamentally change the system of rules and norms in our region that we all work by, and it wants to change them in a way that is not in Australia's interests. We are going to have to find a way to navigate through that. We're going to have to make daily decisions about which course we take in response to that. Over the long term, personally, I think that we're going to have to bind more closely to other countries in our region, Japan, India, Indonesia, South Korea, sort of reasonably like-minded countries that are also concerned about the trajectory that China is taking, binding together, not as a containment policy, but just as a way of trying to shore up our mutual interests and also to keep the United States as involved as possible. I think they will remain part of Asia, they will remain involved in Asia, but we cannot be 100% certain that they will remain as involved as they have been in the past. We need to try and influence that as much as possible.
Well, it's certainly not going to be the last time that we're going to hear about a breach like this. I'm sure we're going to keep having to deal with this many times over in the next few years. Thank you both for joining us. Listeners, you can read David Rowe's coverage of this every day in The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. And now you'll be able to read Chris Yorman's analysis every second Wednesday in both papers. We'll be back after this short break.
Kate McClymont here from the investigative team at The Herald. Much of what we do is giving a voice to the unheard and holding the powerful to account. Whether it's rampant underpayment in the fast food industry, sexual harassment in the entertainment world, or uncovering Australia's recycling crisis, our coverage proves the value of investigative journalism. Good reporting needs supporters. Subscribe today for just 50 cents a day. Just look for subscribe on any of our websites.
The Oscars are upon us, and I'm joined by senior writer and film buff Gary Maddox. While statements of equality dominated last year's awards, this year controversy is already brewing.
Will the main event backfire? So much is riding on Oscar night, and the show is taking some huge risks.
Moves announced by the Academy today help or hurt the Oscars?
Host Kevin Hart was dropped after old homophobic tweets resurfaced. A new category, achievement in popular film, was dumped after a blowback from critics. And a petition from Hollywood luminaries has led to organisers backflipping on their decision to hold presentations during the commercial ad break. It's a far cry from the original intent of the Academy and the Oscars in the 1920s to stave off unionisation in Hollywood.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences 25th Annual Academy Awards.
With so much in the lead up to this Academy Awards, Gary, what are we going to expect on the night?
It's been a really interesting lead up to the awards this year, Tori. The Academy have made so many missteps on the way to actually trimming the broadcast. They're obviously desperate to increase the television viewing numbers for the awards and also respond to some of the movements which have been around, you know, causing political concerns in the last few years. The Oscar So White movement, the Me Too movement. So what they've done are a series of issues that have all blown up into controversies. It started with trying to introduce a most popular film category, which people responded to quite not unsurprisingly by saying, well, that means you're going to give an Oscar to a Transformers movie, does it? The Academy, after a bit of outrage, backed down from that, put it on hold. They then announced that Kevin Hart was going to be the host for it. And after kind of the emergence of sort of past homophobic statements by him, he dropped out.
I apologize. I'm now moving on from this, because I'm just hoping that the apology is accepted.
And the Academy decided they were going to go ahead without a host, which again is problematic. It's something that traditionally the host, you know, sets the agenda for the awards, holds it together when it ebbs and flows, gives it a kind of a consistency.
Steps and of course, in when the wrong movie is awarded right. Best Picture.
That's right. Jimmy Kimmel stepped in and kind of saved the day a bit when they announced, that, you know, 2 years ago that La La Land had wrongly won Best Picture ahead of Moonlight. So the host has got a big job there and they're going to go this year without a host.
So how does that even work? How do they not do that? Are they just going to have like a voiceover person announcing the people giving the award?
That's very interesting because we don't actually know how it's going to work yet. They've announced that Queen are going to perform with Adam Lambert in the Freddie Mercury role, so maybe they'll open the show with that and give it a kind of an energy and a currency that'll appeal to a television viewership. But they've hopefully got some sort of surprise up their sleeve that can actually, you know, give this award some sort of cohesion, because 3+ hours without a host, with a lot of kind of presenters standing awkwardly doing very bad jokes with each other, could be a very long night.
So it all kind of smells a bit desperate.
There is. It does feel like a touch of desperation about how they've reacted. A lot of it has been so impulsive. You would think after the messing up Best Picture 2 years ago, they go back, they rethink, they actually streamline the awards, they kind of make it more current. Well, one thing they have done well is refresh the membership, but they've also jumped at kind of straws all the way to try and grab people's attention, and none of them have worked. And the most recent one was attempting to streamline the production, you know, the actual awards ceremony by saying that we're going to have 4 of the awards handed out during the commercial breaks and then seamlessly slipped into the telecast in a trimmed down version later on, and the industry were justifiably outraged by this, because the Academy has backed down from that as well.
Right. So do you think the Oscars are struggling for relevance?
Look, I hate to say it, I love the Oscars. I love what they stand for. I love the kind of honouring excellence. I love the fact that it draws people's attention to films that we haven't seen, and films that, you know, haven't got the budget to, you know, get the kind of mainstream audience otherwise. As we sort of approach the Oscars here, it is a bit problematic, without a doubt.
Okay, so let's talk about the movies. This is the first year that they've had that Netflix has been nominated for Best Picture.
That's right.
For Roma. Tell me about Roma.
Roma is a film that will have to break all sorts of barriers if it's going to win Best Picture. I actually love it. I think it's deservedly favourite to win Best Picture. But it's a foreign language film, and as far as I can tell, no foreign language film has ever won Best Picture in the history of the Oscars, and there have only been not even 2 handfuls of films that have been nominated.
So how did this one break through? Is it that extraordinary, or do you think it was more of a play for relevance by putting a Netflix film in the Best Picture category?
I think it is actually maybe the film of the Oscars this year that will be talked about for years and years, that will be a lasting film. It's a very powerful black and white, almost a childhood memoir. Alfonso Cuarón, who won Best Director for Gravity, he's one of this kind of Mexican trio of directors who've been dominating the Oscars in recent years. He has made a story, a very touching and heartfelt story, about the influence of his family's maid stroke nanny as he was growing up, and how her, in her own kind of dignified way, held the family together during a crisis. And by telling this story in black and white, beautifully photographed, and he did so many roles on it. He wrote it, directed, produced it, shot it himself, co-edited it. Real kind of auteur sort of work. He's made a very moving story, which is about things like stoicism and things like dignity and family and love and Mexican history. And it is actually, to my mind, a very powerful film. Had a brief cinema run to qualify, and had a cinema run here in Australia as well, but it's kind of a Netflix film and it's a big play for Best Picture.
Okay, so the other one that everyone is talking about as being a controversial one to have in Best Picture is the one about Freddie Mercury.
That's right, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Overdub 24 of Fred's thing. Galileo
Figaro. How was that? Better?
Higher.
Jesus, how many more Galileos do you want?
Freddie wants to do a few more overdubs.
Do we even have any tape left?
I do have to say, the tape is wearing out. It can't take much more.
It was a bit of a surprise pick for Best Picture, because it ended up being, despite the Academy's thoughts that they needed to have, you know, commercial relevance by a most popular film character, they had actually had three genuine hits up for Best Picture. Black Panther, the superhero movie, A Star is Born, the musical remake, and also Bohemian Rhapsody, a real surprise success. It's a really entertaining film. It's a really crowd-pleasing film. But
it's the only nominee for Best Picture that I've actually seen.
There you go.
I loved it, but I didn't walk out thinking, wow, that was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. I just found it incredibly entertaining, and it made me want to listen to Queen a lot.
That's right. I think you're in a lot of the categories. A lot more people would have seen Bohemian Rhapsody than Roma, without a doubt, and a lot of the other contenders too. That's quite common for Best Picture, and one of the reasons that people sort of turn away a little bit. The Academy a few years ago announced that they would have up to 10 films up for Best Picture, whereas they used to have only 5. So that broadened theoretically broaden the appeal of the Oscars, but it also, it's brought in certain films that, you know, you might question whether they deserve to be there. Bohemian Rhapsody, great fun, tremendous last half hour. The songs are so great.
Give you goosebumps.
But Does it deserve to be up for Best Picture? Yeah, I might argue against it. But.
And where do you stand on A Star Is Born?
Tell me something, girl.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they liked the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
I really enjoyed it as a film. I was quite moved by it. I don't think it stayed with me quite as much as some of the other films in the Oscars Best Picture field. Some of the others, there are three films in there that are kind of racially charged that, you know, speak to something about what's going on in America at the moment. There's Green Book, which is, in some people's eyes, the favourite to win Best Picture because it won the main award at the Producers Guild Awards. It's kind of a road movie about a New York bouncer taking a black classical pianist on a tour of America's South at the time of the sort of civil rights era. And both confronting elements of racism in their own eyes.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to dine here.
I'm afraid not.
How does he smile and shake their hands like that?
Because it takes courage to change people's hearts.
To me, the sort of politics are not quite there to actually have it win Best Picture, so I'd probably be surprised if it does. But as mentioned, Roma has a lot of barriers to win. It's 2.25 hours long. It's a foreign language film. It's a Netflix film, and a lot of people in Hollywood would see that as being a barrier because they think of it as TV. And, you know, this is the great disruptor. Why would we reward the great disruptor of the cinema industry?
So we have two Australians nominated in this year's Academy Awards, and they're both in with a pretty good chance, aren't they? Can you tell me about them?
I think they are. Tony McNamara took a script by Deborah Davis for a reasonably conventional story about Queen Anne, the sort of frail ruler of the 18th century, and her kind of hold on power and the relationship of the people around her. And he, once the Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos took it on and employed Tony McNamara, they turned into a really savage kind of witty story about two cousins who battle and scrap for the attentions and also space in the bed of the frail Queen Anne.
The Queen is an extraordinary person.
They were all staring, weren't they? I can tell even if I can't see, and I heard the word fat, and ugly.
No one but me would dare, and I did not.
She's been stalked by tragedy.
Everyone leaves me. Dies.
It's very entertaining. It's got 10 nominations, including Best Picture and Director, and Tony McNamara has been winning the lead-up awards and I think has a really excellent chance of winning Best Original Screenplay.
And what about our other contender?
Fiona Crombie is up for production design. It has a beautiful look, The Favourite. It's kind of a royal court film. The Oscars have always loved costume dramas and kings and queens over the years.
Don't we all?
That's right. In this case, they've given it a kind of a twist, a very clever twist. The whole thing has a sort of a look which plays into the comedy, the sort of the wit of the whole film. And she would probably be, I would say, equal favourite to win that with Black Panther. Black Panther is another film that also has a pretty extraordinary look. A superhero film that broke all sorts of boundaries, you know, kind of being a film about with a largely black cast and a black director, was a tremendous box office success, has sort of themes about African-American identity. So there's a lot of things going on there, and it just looks amazing, you know. If I would think that if Fiona Crombie doesn't win, and she might well, I would, you know, we obviously great to see her from an Australian perspective, then maybe Black Panther is the biggest competition.
I waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
Well, fingers crossed for our Aussies. When can people see the Oscars, Gary?
The Oscars are on at noon on Monday. It will
when
be
when most of us are at work and aren't allowed to watch television.
That's right.
Except us.
We're that's lucky. Right. There's usually a very good blog on a certain Sydney Morning Herald Age website that's worth
that's
catching
a good point.
At the time. And then there's generally a telecast in the evening. Even though it's sort of coming in with a sort of strange lead up, there's always drama. There's always unexpected things happen. hopefully not the best picture mix-up again. There's always kind of funny things. There's always awful things that give people things to talk about. I always find it tremendously entertaining, however it turns out.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being on Please Explain.
Thanks, Dory.
Thanks to our guests this week, David Rowe, Chris Uhlman and Gary Maddox. And special thanks to Amelia Maguire, who this week more than ever kept the show on the road. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them. Or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. If you want to get in touch, you can. Our email is in the show notes. This episode was produced and edited by Nicole Presell and David Escort. Technical assistance from David McMillan. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.